It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Hello, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great to be with you today. This is the Larry Kudlow Show, and you can live stream us. You can live stream us over the internet, wabcradio.com or larrykudlowshow.com. Hear us all across the country, all around the globe, and throughout the solar system. Of course, we have a big following in the solar system. That's why the Chinese think they're going to take the moon and Mars. They want to stop the Larry Kudlow Show, but they can't possibly do it. And during the week, Fox Business, the name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. And if for some reason you can't be there at 4, you can dial up your favorite 9-year-old. We'll show you how to DVR the show. Anyway, we have much to talk about, as always, and I want to start with my pal Lee Zeldin. I know it's been heavily reported, but I want to weigh in on it. Republican congressman from Long Island, a Republican candidate for governor, in my humble opinion, the last hope for New York State, the last hope for New York State. He's running against a far-left incumbent who's never been elected, Hochul, who replaced Cuomo. She is super soft on crime, high taxes, far-left socialist, captured by the far-left AOC wing of her party, shows no signs of breaking free of it. She's a corrupt governor, almost $1 trillion in cash to this Buffalo sports stadium. Her husband has the concessions. We've just found in the last week or two that other gifts from the state have been spread around for her donors. I mean, she's corrupt. She's soft on crime. She's high tax. She doesn't care a whit about businesses or the economy. In the she's definitely in the grips of the teachers union, teaching critical race theory in our schools, trying to stop school choice. I mean, it's just awful, awful candidate. Couldn't be worse. Lee Zeldin will break this up. And, of course, as we all know, this crazy guy tried to attack Lee with some kind of two-pronged keychain thing. Lee's a black belt. He's a black belt. And he held him off, got hold of his wrist, held him off. Waited for people to tackle him. And the good news is, I mean, I heard this. I was having dinner Thursday night with Mr. John Katsimatidis, who is the WABC radio owner and a great friend and a fabulous American. He and Margot, sort of the de facto mayor of New York. But anyway, then I came home and John texted me that Zeldin had been attacked. And then texted quickly later that Zeldin was okay. I texted Lee Zeldin almost immediately, and not long after he texted back that he was okay, thanked me for being concerned about him. You know, I have pushed Zeldin on this show unabashedly. I will continue to push him on this show throughout this election. I pushed him during the primary. I thought he was the best candidate. Rob Astorino is a good guy, and so is Young Giuliani, but I felt Zeldin had by far the best chance. He has a terrific record as a House member in Congress, always a conservative, strong on crime, low-tax member of the New York legislature, the state Senate, and so forth. Zeldin can win. He really is the common-sense guy, and he would restore tough penalties. I mean, the worst part of this story, I mean, fortunately, obviously, with God's grace, Zeldin wasn't hurt. It was really an assassination attempt is what it was. To some extent, even further along than the assassination attempt on Judge Brett Kavanaugh in Washington, because this guy actually came at Zeldin. The other one just had a gun intended to go after Brett Kavanaugh. But you can't go after a House member, right? A sitting congressman. You can't do that. That's against federal law. Now, here's the rub. The guy who went after Zeldin has now been released. He is gone free, right? First of all, the DA or the attorney yeah, the local DA up in, I guess, Monroe County, Rochester, New York, where this rally took place, where Zeldin was speaking. I mean, the DA comes up with a second-degree attempted murder, which is a very weak charge, in my opinion. But given the crazy laws from the state legislature, the far-left socialist state legislature, which the far-left governor, Hochul, continues to support, the guy gets out, the attacker gets out, no bail, no detention, no nothing. All right, if he has these mental problems, as has been described, he should be locked up in a mental institution under observation and diagnosis, evaluation. None of this happened. So you've got two things cooking here. One is the incredibly dangerous attack on a sitting member of the U.S. House of Representatives who happens to be a candidate for governor of the state of New York. Secondly, the attacker gets off scot-free and is walking around. I mean, in a sense, that says it all about the crime wave in New York City and New York State. Soft-on-crime politicians, Democratic politicians, who've been running this state now for years. George Pataki was the last decent governor we had. My pal George Pataki was a good governor. Three terms. Good governor. Cut taxes. Cut taxes, tough on crime. Piloted us through the 9/11 crisis with the great mayor, Rudy Giuliani. And then we've had this long string, you know, Cuomo, as New York deteriorates, city and state. It deteriorates because the crime situation is awful, because of high taxes and regulations that are driving out businesses, going down to Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, you name it, and the education system's a disaster. With the teachers' unions that have a gridlock, have a hammerlock on this education system, teaching critical race theory, gender and sex identification, it's all nonsense. All nonsense. It's all about race. It's exactly what it shouldn't be. They've ruined the schools. They're ruining our kids. Those three areas, in my view, crime, taxes, education, all right? There's a lot of other things that need to be discussed. Zeldin is the solution. Hochul and the crazy left-wing socialist Democrats are the problem. I can't be any clearer than that. And if you disagree with me, I understand and I respect the disagreement, as always. That's the way I operate. I'm not going to call you names, but I'm just giving you my view with as much humility as I have, as my view. I have been living in New York for, let's see, I came here, I was finished grad school at Princeton in 1973, came to New York in the autumn of 73, working for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Started my career there. That is a long time ago. 50 years? I don't know. You do the math. Long time ago. I had 6 years in Washington, working for Ronald Reagan, and came back to New York. And more recently, I had 3 years in Washington working for President Donald Trump. So I've been here a long time, on and off. Never seen the city worse. Never. City economy. The problems with crime. Every day you read the New York Post, which is such a great paper. One thing after another. Shootings, muggings, horrible things. Horrible things. The mismanagement of COVID, the lockdowns, the idea of masking little kids, the incredibly high, first in the nation in taxes, first in the nation in regulations, first in the nation in hating businesses. Have you ever heard one of these Democratic politicians say something good about business? Nope. They don't care. They want to spend the budget of New York State is outrageous. What did I see? Florida has higher population now than New York State. New York State's budget is twice the size of Florida. I mean, how ridiculous is that? Welfareism. You don't need to look for a job to get welfare, various welfare programs. Highest taxes in the country. Maybe we're tied with New Jersey, which is another socialist paradise. Governor of New Jersey, Phil Murphy's a nice guy. He was a friend of mine when I worked in the White House, but policy-wise, I couldn't disagree more. Connecticut's no better. Maybe a little bit better, tiny bit better. We live in the city during the week, obviously, because I work at Fox. We have a country place up in Connecticut, an hour and a half from the city. Zeldin has got to win. It's that simple. And his attacker goes free on the street, on the streets. It's a perfect example, illustration of what is wrong with this city and state run by Democrats for so many years. Once the Republicans lost control of the state Senate, bunch of years back, that was it. Game over. The far left is running the, and we love New York. Can I just tell you that, folks? I love being in the city during the week. I have so many friends in the city. I work in the city. I mean, I have all these years, almost 50 years on and off. And I've seen the city great. I've seen it great. And then I've seen it not so great. Now I've seen it awful. And I don't want it to be that way. I want New York to be great again. I want a new New York. What I'm telling you is Lee Zeldin, who was a black belt, fought this guy off. Lee Zeldin, who's in the army. Lee Zeldin, who's a superb congressman, tough on crime, low taxes, deregulation, school choice reform. Tough on crime. Lee Zeldin's going to be the last hope. I mean, I've been saying this for months. I've had Lee on as a guest so many times. Lee will be on today's show later to talk about it. I worked with him in the Trump years. He's a very common sense guy. He's just saying, you know, folks, there's nothing radical about wanting to punish criminals and defend victims. There's nothing radical about defending the cops to make the city and state safe. There's nothing radical about trying to reduce the highest taxes in the country. There's nothing radical in trying to persuade entrepreneurs and successful men and women in businesses, including small business, including bodega owners. There's nothing radical about trying to keep them here and making it safe and more profitable for them to live and work here with their families and decent schooling. That is, to use John Catsimatidis' term, common sense. Are you with me? Common sense is what New York needs. God bless that Lee Zeldin is safe, staved off this crazy attacker. But the rest of this story has got to change. And I will once again endorse Zeldin. I've done it, I don't know, four or five times in the last 6, 8 months, whatever. He'll be on the show, at least coming on the show later. So we'll have some time with him, listen to him. But folks, I just want to say, if you love New York as I do, and I do, if you live and work in New York as I do, as so many of you out there do, if you come visit New York, as tourists, families, friends, this story here in New York has got to change. We need new political leadership. Lee Zeldin's the one. Lee Zeldin is the one. By the by, there should be federal prosecution. Andy McCarthy is exactly right in his piece in the New York Post, because he's a sitting congressman. And no one is taking any action. The Democratic Justice Department, you know, Merrick Garland. Why the heck isn't he prosecuting this crazy guy who's now scot-free? It's part of the story. It's part of this bad story. You know how to make a situation better? Change it. Change it. You know how to make New York better? Elect Zeldin. It's real simple. He's the last hope. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll take a quick break and be right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I want to switch gears now, talk a little bit about Washington, and really a huge Republican mistake. I mean, look, you know me. The cavalry's coming. The cavalry's coming. There's going to be a big change in politics in Washington, D.C. because of the phenomenal across-the-board mistakes, disasters, catastrophe of the Biden big government socialists, the radical left agenda on climate activism, run this country into the ground, took a very healthy economy growing at 6.5% 18 months ago with less than 2% inflation, and now we're facing a recession. 18 months later, the first half of this year, the GDP will have fallen, contracted. We'll get the official number later this week. I think it comes out Thursday or Friday. I'll have to check that. But the point is, the Bidens have taken a strong economy, run it into the ground because of their crazy spending policies, their attempts to impose gigantic taxes, their massive climate activism, which has contributed to inflation and high energy prices, symbolized by now, whatever, $4.50 average gas at the pump, which is crazy, over $100 oil, et cetera, et cetera. They are soft on crime, just like Hochul, perfect. Hochul's the Biden of New York, just like Richard Blumenthal, Senator Blumenthal is the Biden of Connecticut. But Republicans here are making a gigantic mistake by supporting this big pork barrel spending allegedly to help American semiconductor chip industry. Now, semiconductors are very important. They're in everything. They're important for national defense. I get that. But here is a terrible story where Chuck Schumer really kind of snookered 16 GOP senators into voting for a shell procedural resolution, and then immediately got what he thinks is a filibuster-proof majority. He's got 64 votes, again, with 16 Republican senators, and turns this thing into a $250 billion spending bill. $250 billion. We're going to out-China China. This is more big government socialist spending. This is corporate welfare. This is industrial policies. This is picking winners and losers. And it is empowering the bureaucracy of the government to run the economy. Exactly what the GOP should be running against. And the House Republicans are against this bill. But unfortunately, the Senate Republicans have, I guess, surrendered to it. I don't know. The final vote's going to be this coming week. $54 billion subsidy to semiconductors. They don't need it, by the way, because there's a boom in semiconductors. And there was a global shortage, but now it's turned into a global glut. $250 billion of private capital investment has gone into that industry. They don't need a $250 billion from the government. $54 billion in subsidies, $24 billion in refundable tax credits, which is just government check writing. $81 billion for the National Science Foundation, a doubling of their budget. $10 billion for the Commerce Department, Standards and Technology, $11 billion for the Commerce Department, something called Regional Technology Hubs. This is all about pork. Pork, pork, pork. pork. $50 billion for an energy department slush fund. This is like Solyndra to the 20th power. Remember Solyndra? Well, you got more. Solyndra run wild. $4 billion for national labs. $1 billion for distressed communities. Oh, my gosh. The worst thing I've ever seen. Spending and inflation. The GOP is going to lose the high ground. We have Senator Rick Scott coming on after the break to talk about this. This is a huge Republican mistake. This is Republicans acting like Democrats, and it's not going to work. And it makes me wonder whether we're going to capture the Senate or not. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back with Senator Rick Scott of Florida to talk about this fiasco bill.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. As advertised, we bring in our great friend, Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who's also the head of the National Republican Senate Campaign Committee. Senator Scott, welcome, sir. I want to play some sound, a clip you made a couple days ago. I actually ran this on our Fox Business show, Kudlow, but I want to play it one more time for our listeners. Let's take a listen.
Intel Corporation made $20 billion last year. Guess what? We're going to give them some money to build a plant. Then we're going to give them a tax deduction for building the plant. And then we're going to give them a tax credit for building the plant. And guess what? They can keep doing business in China.
Well, Senator, I kind of thought you nailed it. And that's the
you
problem.
You can't make this stuff up, right?
Yes, that's right. Sure. I'm so disappointed.
Can you see why we have $30 trillion worth of debt? This is why. We spend money with no accountability. It's broken. And why do we have inflation? Because Washington just wants to spend every dime they can. They don't care about the debt. They don't care about the deficit. They don't care about inflation. And they don't care about accountability. It is frustrating.
It's got to be frustrating. By the way, nowhere have I heard anybody even whisper about a pay for. All right. Now, we don't want to raise taxes. We could cut spending elsewhere, but we don't need this monstrosity anyway. This is a big political, industrial planning, you know, picking winners and losers, exactly what I thought conservatives were opposed to. Now, Rick, the thing that's so bad is 16 Republican senators voted for the procedural resolution, and then Chuck Schumer comes in and snookers everybody with a $250 billion bill. Why is the GOP helping him?
Well, I hope we don't. I mean, we can stop this. I mean, this is just a giveaway with no accountability. I mean, Larry, you and I want to make sure we build things in America. We want to make sure we hold China accountable. I'm all in. I think you're all in on this stuff. But think about this. Why don't we just say, oh, we're not going to buy any products with the government could say, we're not going to buy any more products made with computer chips made in China. That would be a way to do it. It wouldn't cost us anything. But this way, we're spending billions of dollars with no accountability, no return. I'm an investor. I'm a business guy. I said if I was going to put money up when I ran companies, I'd say, hey, if you want capital, what are we going to – we got to get a return on it because the bank or the shareholders are not going to want us to do that. I feel like that's my job in the Senate. I'm a fiduciary for the taxpayer. The taxpayer in this case gets no money back. There's no return to the taxpayer. But Intel Corporation, these big chip makers, it's a boondoggle for them. So they're out lobbying for this. They've hired all these lobbyists. So they come up here and say, oh, we've got a crisis here of semiconductors. Now, we're not going to say, oh, we want you to build specific semiconductors that we need. No, that would be too much. And we're not going to say that you have to stop doing business in China. By the way, Intel Corporation, their CEO, who made $180 million last year, which I'm happy people make money, he said after China invades Taiwan, he's not going to change his business practice at all. He's going to continue to do business in communist China. That's disgusting.
Mm. Didn't some of this, Senator Scott, some of this Intel money, Intel's building a big plant in Germany, too. I mean, I'm not against Germany, but again, like you, I'd like homegrown onshoring activity wherever possible. And he's going to build this plant in Ohio anyway. I mean, and I know Rob Portman's voting for this, but the fact is he's going to build this plant. He's already started to build this plant. And the other thing, Senator, is private investment capital is flowing into the industry, which is very profitable. The trade group, the Semiconductor Industry Association, they've said, if you look at their website, $250 billion of private capital is flowing into that industry. Why does the federal government have to put another $250 billion into it? I don't get that.
Yeah, well, it's good for these semiconductor companies. It's bad for the taxpayer. And we don't get anything. If we're supposed to say we're against China controlling things, let's do something that says that. And by the way, Intel, we give them all this money. They don't have any obligation to stop doing business in China it makes you mad. We got to stop wasting your money. We got to balance this budget. We got to get this inflation under control. Look at what it's doing. I can tell you, I just did a roundtable, and I'm in Tampa today. I just did a roundtable of business people. I mean, they're struggling with supply chain problem. They're struggling with inflation. They can't get people to come back to work. I mean, their businesses are not open like they used to be because they can't get enough people to work. The restaurants, the manufacturing companies. We've got to start fixing this country. And this administration, these Democrats, don't want to do anything. It's not that hard. Balance the budget. Reduce taxes. Reduce fees. Reduce the regulation. Reduce the permitting time. That'll get people back to work.
Yeah, it'd be a lot cheaper. That's right. It'd be a lot cheaper if we extended the Trump tax cuts, particularly the corporate tax cuts. It'd be a lot cheaper.
I
just
put out
to
a
give...
plan that would do that.
Yeah.
Larry, I put out a plan that said one, if you're able-bodied, okay, you ought to go back to work. Number two is we got to extend the Trump tax cuts. I mean, they had an unbelievable impact on our economy. And the Biden and the Democrats want to get rid of it. It's going to hurt our economy big time. It's going to hurt jobs in this country.
I mean, the mystery to me, Senator Scott, is why so many Republicans want to back a Biden-Schumer-Pelosi bill. And we, the Republicans, conservatives, have the high ground. I mean, as you note, we want to cut taxes and deregulate, freeze spending or cut domestic spending, keep the dollar strong to fight inflation. We have the high ground because of the disastrous Biden policies that have taken a great economy and run it into the ground, into a combination of inflation and recession. Why would 16 GOP senators back this stuff? This is Biden, Schumer, Pelosi stuff. And I think it's going to undercut the GOP arguments for the November elections, at least among the senators.
Well, I'm responsible for the Senate committee, help our candidates win. We've got 21 Republicans up, seats up. We've got only 14 Democrats, but it's going to be a lot of work, but we've got great candidates. We've got a lot of energy. The public is fed up with the Biden administration. So we have to just raise our money. We raise the money, and the Democrats right now are out raising it. So if we raise our money, we're going to have a great November, and hopefully at that point we can stop all this nonsense. But $30 trillion in debt with Biden's plan on taking it to 45 is pretty scary.
In the Republican Senate conference, can you make the case to your colleagues that this is no time to back a big spending pork barrel industrial policy bill? Can you try to persuade them that this is the wrong path?
I'm doing my best, but what really persuades people is when people call and say, hey, look, we got to quit spending money like this, and what's our return? I'm a taxpayer. I don't want to spend my money like this. So what I ask people to do is call their House member, call their senator, say, look, tell me how this makes any sense. Look, we all want to make sure we produce everything we can in America, but we can't do it where we're paying people to build it, paying people, give them a tax break for building it, and give them a tax credit. That makes no sense. You know, what I did when I was governor of Florida, Larry, I did economic development projects. But what I said is I'm going to make at least five times, not just get my money back, five times my money, or I won't give you any money. And I only did projects where it was something that wouldn't cover Florida, like a light manufacturing or a back office or a regional office that didn't have to be in Florida. And so by doing that, I helped a lot of businesses grow, but I got a return for the taxpayer. This bill has no return for the taxpayer. It's going to cause inflation, more debt, more deficits.
Yeah, we're going to get some numbers this week, Senator Scott, I think it's Thursday, but the second quarter GDP report comes out. It is likely to be a negative. We already had a negative in the first quarter, and it's going to be combined with about an 8% inflation rate. Now, this is the demise of the Biden policies and the Biden presidency. This is the best argument for Republicans because this, you know, this big government socialism has failed so badly. The radical climate activism has failed so badly. But, I mean, it gives a, you know, it gives the GOP a lot to run on, and presumably they know how to fix it. But when you vote for a bill like this, $250 billion pork barrel bill, that really, I mean, this is my worry, Senator Scott. It just undercuts the GOP position. And I know the cavalry's coming, and I know there's some good candidates. A lot of these candidates are newcomers. They're not responsible for this. But it just concerns me that we're giving the Democrats ammunition. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, bipartisan spending.
I agree. Larry, I agree with you. We got to stand for what we believe in.
Yes.
We have to go sell it. And if you just think about it, you know, I grew up in a poor family. I watched my mom struggle with inflation. This is inflationary. Government spending causes inflation. And so how can we stand and say, oh, we don't like deficits, we don't like debt, we don't like inflation, when we spend money on things that we know we get no return for? We can't do that. We've got to stop doing that.
Well, what do you hear about the final vote? I think Schumer's going to want to get cloture Monday, I think he said.
I think they're talking about the cloture vote and then the final vote on Wednesday. So we'll see. I think along with others are trying to make sure everybody understands. And I've got an amendment. That so far Schumer said I can't have. And my amendment's pretty simple. It says, number one, if you take the money, right, you cannot continue to expand in China. Hmm. Number two is if China invades Taiwan, you've got to stop doing business in China. Number three is if we don't get all of our money back, over the next 10 years of what we gave you through increased tax revenues from your company as a result of the investment, you have to give us the money back. Hmm. It's pretty simple.
Hmm. How does it look around the country now? You're running the campaign committee. How does it look? Where are the toughest races, Senator Scott?
Well, it's going to come down to probably seven states. So 50-50 Senate, we got to keep our 50 that we have now. The three hardest to defend will be Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. He's running a great race. Mehmet Oz has to win Pat Toomey's seat in Pennsylvania. He's running a very good race. I was with Ted Budd yesterday in North Carolina helping him raise money. So I tell people, if you want to help us, you know, raise money, you can text WIN to 55404. But I was there. Then our pickup opportunities are Herschel Walker in Georgia, Adam Laxalt in Nevada. Whoever wins a Republican primary, they can beat Kelly in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And whoever wins a Republican primary can beat Haslam up in New Hampshire. We've got some great candidates in Colorado and Washington, harder states to win, but we have a shot there. So we have three we have to defend, six potential pickup opportunities. So it's good candidates, very good candidates, great year. We just have to raise our money.
I got one for you. I know it's a long shot, but I think in Connecticut, Themis Claridis, I think she's going to win the primary. I have nothing against Leora Levy. She's a fine woman, but I think Themis is going to win. And I think Richard Blumenthal, who was the Joe Biden of Connecticut, he can be beaten. Your poll, your campaign committee poll, when he ran against a generic Republican, it was about even. I think he was plus two. Right. Themis can win that race.
Shot there. Absolutely. Here's the key. We're going to get a good candidate out of the race in Connecticut. Blumenthal has got very poor approval ratings. So if we, one, we have to raise our money. Two, we have to run a good campaign to get our vote out. It's not just making sure from a poll standpoint people want to elect us. They got to show up at the polls. So we got to get volunteers to go out there and help us get the vote out, because it really takes work, to remind people to vote, to make sure they get to the, to the polls, all these things. And when we do, you're right. I think we have a really good shot in Connecticut. But we've got to raise our money. That's why, you know, I probably bug people too much, but I tell them, you know, if you want to help us, text WIN to 55404, because, you know, that's how we win. We got to be able to tell our story, because the incumbents could raise more money. Blumenthal will have more money, whether it's Leo or Thames, you know, he'll have more money. So we don't have to have as much money, but we have to have resources to be able to tell our story.
You know, are you following this story in New York, Lee Zeldin running for governor?
So can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, somebody wants to kill the guy, a governor candidate, and they let him out of jail immediately?
But apocryphal. That's the Democrats, isn't it?
Why people want to leave New York. They're fed up with these soft-arm crime policies. You know, we got a candidate in North Carolina, the Democrat. She was a Supreme Court justice there in North Carolina. All she did was let criminals out. I mean, it's like, my mom would have been furious with me if I did anything wrong, and I knew that on top of getting in trouble with her, I would be in jail for doing something like that.
Yeah, I think besides the fiscal stuff and the climate stuff, Senator, I think soft on crime is a very big issue. It's a national issue.
I agree.
Here, even in New York, I mean, people are furious at what's going on. They are just furious.
I always think elections come down to your livelihood, so it's either job, inflation, your children's education, so they want school choice. They don't want their kids taught critical race theory. Number three, they want them to be safe. And so that's what you should talk about. And you have to show people that you care about them. You've got to show people that you're competent. But talk about the issues they care about. That's what people care about. A lot of this other stuff, they're interested in it, but they really care about, can I support my family? My kids get a good education. Is my neighborhood safe? Mm-hmm. And if it's not, I got a problem.
Well, I know you're very busy. We appreciate your time here on a Saturday morning, Senator Rick Scott of Florida. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for your friendship, Larry.
Thank you
for what you do every day.
No, terrific, sir. It's a pleasure to be friends with you. Good luck today. Good luck on the campaign. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be right back with some closing comments on this crazy $250 billion bill. Honestly, this is something the Republicans should be against, not for.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
So, welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I am going to beat this dead horse with all respect to horses. I mean, this bill is a symbol of everything wrong that the Biden Democrats have tried to push on the American taxpayer, American families, American working folks, and the American economy. I mean, $250 billion. First of all, as Senator Scott said, this is inflationary. This is just more spending. And spending is what got us into trouble in the first place, beginning with the so-called relief bill of March of 2021 that the Biden Democrats got, and that launched the inflation. So here we are. It ain't $5 trillion, but $250 billion is a lot of money. And you've got all this pork barrel stuff in here. You know, slush funds for the Commerce Department. Slush funds for the Energy Department. Again, Solyndra to the 20th power. Slush funds for the semiconductor industry. They're already getting $250 billion of private capital in the last couple of years. It's a lot of money. Private investment is what makes America great. We are for free market capitalism. Free market, free enterprise. We are not for big government socialism. And this bill is an example of big government socialism. We're going to out-China China, right? They're the ones with a centrally planned, state-run economy, which, by the way, is going down. You know, take a look at their numbers. When they had the free market reforms 40 years ago, started by this Deng Xiaoping, that was a big deal, and it opened up the China economy, and all of a sudden China became a big grower, powerful, global economic power, because they adopted free market capitalism. They allowed ownership. They allowed profits. They allowed new companies, new enterprises, entrepreneurs. Now, in the last 10 years with Xi Jinping and his predecessors, they've begun to close down economic freedom and all other freedoms for that matter. And what they've done with the Uyghurs is a catastrophe. What they've done in Hong Kong is a catastrophe. What they could do to Taiwan would be a catastrophe. But that is not something America should emulate. We can't out-China China. We can't out-central planning the central planners. We cannot imitate communism. Now, I'm not saying this is a communist bill, but you get my point. This is just more power to Washington. Again, picking winners and losers. I don't even know how they're going to channel the money to the specific semiconductor companies. We have a dozen huge, world-class, leading semiconductor. We have, the Taiwan Semiconductor, which is a great company in Taiwan, they're moving to Arizona. Samsung's moving to Texas. They're coming here because we have a more favorable investment climate, presuming we keep that favorable investment climate. And as Senator Scott said, this is balloon the deficit. Ballooning the deficit and ballooning spending will cause inflation. We've got $30 trillion worth of debt. The Biden budget would run it up to $40 trillion if he ever got it through. Biden wants to raise taxes to finance more spending. And then you have all these social justice policies that will be, there'll be strings tied to this money. I don't know if the semiconductor people understand this. I've spoken to one or two of those CEOs who are not in favor of this bill. Intel, they have lagged badly in recent years. I don't want to badmouth Intel, but I'm just saying Intel crying out for government help. This is a company that was once the world leader. It's no longer the world leader. So they want government help, government money. And I say the taxpayer, Senator Rick Scott is exactly right. He is exactly right. But worse than that, it troubles me that throwing in with Chuck Schumer on this $250 billion bill, without any real guardrails to invest in China or Europe or wherever, throwing in with Schumer and Biden on this bill will undercut the Republican election position. They are supposed to have the fiscal high ground. Make the Trump tax cuts permanent. Deregulate energy and all businesses. Freeze domestic spending. But this kind of thing undermines their position. And I find that very, very troubling. Anyway, we will continue after this break. We have the great energy scientist, Steve Koonin, to tell us again all the lies about climate change being spread by Joe Biden and his cronies. This is zealous radical climate activism is wrecking our economy.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. This is the Larry Kudlow Show. It is a great pleasure to be with you. You can live stream us on the internet, by the way, wabcradio.com or larrykudlowshow.com. It's all in the same spot. Run us all around the country, throughout the world, and the solar system. And during the week, please join us. Fox Business, name the show is Kudlow, Monday through Friday, 4 to 5 p.m. If you can't make it at 4, call up your favorite 9-year-old who will show you how to DVR the show, and you'll never miss a thing. And we bring in my favorite climate expert, Steve Koonin, who was formerly the top energy scientist for the Obama administration. He's currently a professor at NYU University. Before that, he was at Caltech. He is the author of the great book, Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. One click on Amazon. It's a very important book. Steve Koonin, thank you for coming back on the radio. You were great on the TV show the other night.
So it was great to be talking with you, Larry.
Thanks, Steve. Well, so let's just review. We got a little more time than we do on the TV. It just seems to me that a lot of people, including the administration, are confused between bad weather and global climate change. That's where I really wanted to start. You have written about this, and let me just look. You wrote a while back in a very good op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, heat waves across the U.S. have become more frequent since 1960, but the U.N. report neglects to mention, or the media neglects to mention, that the body of the report shows they're no more common today than they were in 1900. Now, the administration and others are making the case that all, you know, it's let's see. Fox Weather says it's 96 degrees in New York City. It's very hot. I get that. But does that mean the world's going to hell in a handbag over climate change?
No, no, of course not, Larry. And, you know, the report that you cited was an official government report from 2018. The graphs are there. They show that the warmest temperatures are not greater than they were in 1900, nor are the heat waves more common than they were in 1900. You know, what we see with heat waves is weather. It happens on timescales or changes of a few days. The heat waves are not going to last more than a few days, either in the U.S. or in Europe, whereas climate is the many-decade average of weather, temperature, winds, humidity, extreme events, and so on. And so people have a tendency, the news media certainly does, to focus on what happens today. That's news. But it's kind of boring to say things have changed by X, Y, or Z over the last 30 years.
What is the climate story going back 100 years, going forward 100 years? Because among other things, I mean, I remember first reading you after you had left the Energy Department years back, and you said the models are deficient. You know, unfortunately, it's a complicated subject. And you know, we're critical of these models. So what's the real story here on climate change?
Well, you know, we have, if we focus on the global average temperature, which is the thing people often talk about, we've seen it warming since the 1600s. We had what's called the Middle Ice Age, and we've gone up in the last century, let's say, by about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. That's globally averaged. It's gotten warmer more rapidly in some places, in the poles, for example, and it tends to get warmer in the evening compared to getting warmer in the daytime. So there are changes, but nevertheless, it's gotten warmer. Now, the real question is, are humans going to be able to, or will humans influence the climate enough so that the warming accelerates, if you like? And, you know, I think we understand that greenhouse gases, mostly CO2, exert a warming influence on the climate. Some human activities, like putting up smog, aerosols, exert a cooling influence on the climate. But on balance, we expect human influences to warm the climate somewhat. And the real issue is, how much is it going to warm? And the best estimate right now is it might warm another 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit by 2100. And then, of course, what can we do about it?
So if it warms by 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit in the next century, what does that mean? Like, what does that mean to the economy? What does that mean to, you know, ordinary folks?
Yes, well, you know, it's very complicated because weather or climate is only one relatively small influence on the economy. Technology, regulation, demographics, and so on are much more important. At least, again, according to the IPCC reports, the UN reports, if one reads them. And what they say is that for a warming of a few degrees, as much as 8 degrees more, that we'll see a few percent hit on the global economy or the U.S. economy in 2100. That means if the economy is growing at 2% a year, a few percent is only a 2 or 3 years worth of growth delayed 70 years from now. And so it's really small.
So that's not 2% a year. That's 2% for the whole period?
That the economy will be 2% smaller. And when I first read that in the official reports, whether it was the 2014 UN report, the 2018 U.S. government report, or the most recent UN report issued last August, they all say a few percent for a few degrees. And that's just mind-boggling when you listen to the political and media dialogues.
So if you had policies that were GDP expanding, economy expanding, now let's say, for example, you cut taxes or you deregulate. It sounds like that would offset over 100 years any of the fairly small climate influence.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if we were to grow at 2% a year between now and the end of the century, the U.S. economy would be four times bigger than it is today, about $85 trillion. Mm. And, you know, take that four times and knock off 2%, and you get something like 3.8 times, all right? Nobody's going to be able to project or tell that difference 70 years from now.
Right, right. So there's a lot of scare tactics going on, basically.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you're quoting...
You know, it could be, you might say, well, the official reports are not right. I don't believe them. Well, okay, but everybody keeps talking about we got to believe the science, and that's what the official science says.
Right. So what do you, besides the potential human influence, what else is influencing these climate trends?
Yeah, well, there are natural cycles in the climate. Probably the most familiar one to non-experts is El Nino, and that happens every 5 or so years. We're currently in what's called the negative phase of the El Nino, which tends to have warmer temperatures in the U.S., for example. Right? When we're in the positive phase, it's wetter and cooler, and we can all remember very rainy seasons when El Nino comes to pass in California, for example. But there are longer-term cycles as well that take 60 or 70 years to play out. There's one in the North Atlantic that influences hurricanes and melting of Greenland. There's another one in the Pacific that similarly has a global influence. And, you know, the interplay between these different cycles, their timing, their strength, will influence global weather patterns.
But there's nothing, I mean, it sounds like, again, it's this panic factor that I hear so much or, you know, it's like an apocalypse now thing. And if we don't, you know, if we don't end carbon in 10 years, we're going to have apocalypse now. I mean, that's just, you're saying that ain't science.
That ain't science and it ain't going to happen. All right. And moreover, I would say it's inhuman. You know, Alex Epstein is one person who's pointed out that there are 3 to 5 billion people who are energy starved. And the best way to get them energy is with fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And if you say we got to reduce emissions, what are you going to tell those people? It's inhuman.
Right. So it's very very negative impact. All right. Thank you for this. This is great stuff. Again, Steve Koonin. Folks, go out and buy his book, would you please? Unsettled, What Climate Science Tells Us, What It Doesn't, and Why It Matters. Steve Koonin, thank you very much, sir.
Great chatting with you, Larry.
Anytime. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk to Alicia Finley, Wall Street Journal columnist, who argues that, you know what, government welfare handouts do more harm than good to the people that get these benefits. I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back after this.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to bring in Alicia Finley, Wall Street Journal columnist and a member of the editorial board, and I want to talk about a very important op-ed she wrote a few days ago. It's called The High Cost of Free Money. The question is, did pandemic stimulus payments actually harm lower-income Americans? And some new important survey results say they did more harm than good. So we bring in Alicia Finley. Alicia, there's always a little more time on radio than TV, so I appreciate your coming back on the radio show.
Sure. It's fun to break down these studies a little in more depth.
So tell us about this Harvard study that you are reporting on.
So what these Harvard social scientists did is they conducted a randomized controlled trial, which in science is how you try to prove causality, that one thing actually causes another rather than is merely associated. So they were actually interested in looking at how cash transfers, just giving people cash, would affect people's financial, physical, psychological well-being. They assigned three groups of people, one to receive $500, one to receive $2,000, and then another to receive nothing, and followed these folks over about 15 weeks, tracked their spending, and also periodically surveyed them on these metrics of physical, psychological, financial health. They also got access to their bank accounts so they could actually track some of the how not only how they spent, but also their overpayment fees, you know, payday loans, etc. And what they found was is that the people who received cash actually performed and fared worse on almost all the metrics, the physical, the psychological, and the financial. They had less liquidity. They had actually lower earned income. They were more lonely. They were more anxious. They were more depressed. And they were just the researchers were just stunned. How could that be? And my hypothesis is if you kind of look down at the results is that it shows that they had less earned income, lower rated work satisfaction, lower rated work performance. Well, they're not working, so maybe that's the reason why they're so depressed. I think the study really actually highlights something that really isn't being discussed enough, is that how cash payment transfers, not only are they ineffective at achieving what their goals, their economic goals, they can actually be harmful to people.
Lisa, you know Arthur Brooks used to run AEI, head think tank?
Yes. He's been a contributor of the journals from time to time.
So years ago, 10, 15 years ago, he wrote about this stuff. And he did all kinds of longitudinal studies that may be similar to what this Harvard study did. But the thing is, I interviewed him once in front of hundreds of people for a national review conference on this very subject. And basically, here's what he put it this way, that work is the most important thing. And people who receive benefits from government are significantly less happy than people who earn their income from work. That the people working were happier than people who weren't working. I mean, I'm simplifying, but it just strikes me that it's so similar to the results that you're citing in your op-ed piece, The High Cost of Free Money. And basically, you're saying here, too, payments make work less rewarding, which reduces feelings of personal well-being. I mean, that's really something. It just... it's depressing to be on the dole. That's basically what you're saying.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that often people at times, you know, these quote unquote experts forget is that, you know, the feelings of self-satisfaction, the self-agency, that you're getting something out or you're doing something important, that also has an effect on your physical health. And that people actually, you know, the people who are feeling more depressed, anxious, lonely, they also suffer, you know, physical toll from that. And we discovered that during the pandemic, the mental health issues. And I have no doubt that the laying off people, the lockdowns combined with the unemployment benefits, the $600 enhanced and then $300 enhanced employment benefits actually contributed to the mental illness because people just weren't working. When you work, you're more kind of socially engaged. You feel like you're actually doing something important. You're being productive. You're earning a paycheck. And so just the lack of work, and this has been, you know, the labor participation rate in the country has been falling for decades. It's ticked up some during the Trump administration, but it's continued to kind of lag during the pandemic and the pandemic recovery. And I have no doubt, again, that is contributing to some of the physical and mental health issues that we're having in this country.
You know, Alicia, So I'm not an expert in this, but it just seems to me in terms of economic policy, America should be generous. We are a very generous country. And when people are in trouble, we help them. And we we may help them too much. I mean, between welfare, food stamps, you know, housing subsidies, unemployment benefits, and all the rest of it. But it would be a good thing, Alicia Finley, it seems to me, that whatever benefits we provide for people who are in trouble, they should return to the policies of work requirements or workfare. In other words, these benefits should not be endless. And what you're saying, what you're reporting here, is that endless benefits make people worse off. We're hurting the very people we hope to help. So I would think restoring workfare to every single one of these benefit programs would be a good thing.
I agree. And I think that's one of the problems with during the pandemic is all these the work requirements. Medicaid never actually included a strict work requirement. Some GOP states during the Trump administration and during the Biden administration have tried to impose them that have been blocked by the courts and then the Biden administration. But during the pandemic, the Biden administration and Congress actually waived work requirements for food stamps. So food stamps were not only increased, but the work requirements for receiving them have been waived so long as the quote-unquote public health emergency is in effect. And who knows when the Biden administration will end that. But the result is that people are just receiving extra food stamp benefits but don't have to do anything to receive them. But I think that that should, to your point, I think that should be a priority for Republicans in the next Congress, assuming that they take over one or both houses, is to try to negotiate some kind of at least authorization, allow states to impose their own work requirements on these programs in return for perhaps giving the Biden, President Biden, something in return. Because otherwise, we saw with the child care tax credit essentially was just a cash payment. $3,600 per child during the pandemic. Luckily, it was allowed to expire at the beginning of this year. But it would just neuter the welfare reforms from the 1990s that had tried to put kind of time limits and work requirements on receiving those payments.
Well, you know, that's right. I was just going to go there. The Clinton-Gingrich reforms on welfare, which established work requirements, there were also some education requirements in that, Alicia. You know, I'd bring them back. I mean, I think they were very successful. A lot of people on the left said everyone was going to fall into poverty. Actually, the results were just the reverse. More people went back to work. We actually had a, you know, blip up in the participation rates.
Yeah, especially there was another study a year or two ago, and I remember writing about this actually shortly before the pandemic, that some researchers studied the welfare reforms from the 1990s and looked at the labor participation of women, single women with children. Hmm. And they found that it actually increased particularly among women actually with more children. And the irony of this is that many people on the left actually gave credit to the earned income tax credit, which actually had nothing to do with it. It was simply the welfare reforms in the 1990s.
Just in the last minute, Alicia Finley, how the earned income tax credit, how would you assess that? Good, bad, middle, what?
I think it's inordinately complicated and it doesn't really have much effect because it doesn't provide the real incentives you need to get people to work. And in fact, I think about one in five of payments is fraudulent or an error. And so actually it's a headache for the IRS to administer. I think it would be just much more cleaner to get rid of that and again provide some kind of work requirements for other welfare benefits.
Great. Alicia Finley, Wall Street Journal editorial board. Read the op-ed piece, please, folks. The high cost of free money. Alicia, thanks very much for coming back on. We appreciate it. Folks, we're going to take a short break. And on the other side of the break, we're going to do some money politics with Liz Peek and Monica Crowley.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity. And the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
This is Greg Kelly. To my friends in the construction business, if you've been injured on the job, make just one call to the Construction Accident Lawyers at the law offices of Darren T. Moore. With hundreds of five-star reviews, they fight for more justice for every client and have secured millions of dollars in compensation for New York construction workers. Call 888-444-ATTY. That's 888-444-2889 for a free consultation. More diligence, more persistence, and more justice. Prior results don't guarantee. Similar outcomes.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. And we've got money and politics. We usually do this in the last half hour, but I got Lee Zeldin coming on, who's still alive, even though his attacker is free. There's no crime. Help the criminals, not the victims. That's the cry in New York State. It's phenomenal. The whole thing's bizarre. But we've got Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and Monica Crowley, former assistant secretary of the Treasury. And what, Monica, you've got? Oh, yeah, the Monica Crowley podcast. I don't want to forget that, the Monica Crowley. When are you going to invite me on the Monica Crowley podcast?
Anytime, Larry. Anytime. You have an open invitation. I can't wait to have you on. Are you kidding?
This is great. So, Liz, you wrote a real winner here for The Hill. I like this. Liberals want voters to blame Biden's age, but his progressive playbook is just as much of a problem. Right. This is the latest shtick. All right. They're all running away from Biden, right, because his polls are in the basement, worse, the sub-basement. But it isn't his policies, right? It's not climate activism. It's not spending. It's not taxing. It's not regulating. It's his age. The poor guy. We just cannot elect anybody. But you're saying, whoops, wait a minute. It could be his policies, all right? Talk some. This is a wonderful column. Everybody should read this column. Go ahead, Liz.
Well, thank you. I mean, I actually think this is real, that when you have all the liberal media turn in one motion and go on attack about Joe Biden's age, you have to sort of think, why are they doing this? Why step away from the president now? And I think, look, here we're coming up to a midterm election where Democrats have very little to run on. They've accomplished almost nothing, even though they're in control of all three branches of government. And where they have made a difference, to your point, like on crime, it's been a disaster. On border, it's been a disaster. On the economy, another disaster. So when voters are assessing whether or not they want to vote Democrat or not, they're going to have to look at these achievements. And I think the media is freaking out because the entire Democratic playbook, Bernie Sanders' playbook in particular, has been shown to be a failure. And so what do they want to do? They want to pin it all on the doddering president. Well, I just don't think that's true, but I think it's an explanation for why they in one voice now, we're all worried about Joe Biden's age.
Monica, what do you think of this? I mean, the media, mainstream media, doesn't know what to do with the fact that Biden is in the dumps. Nobody likes him, okay? The Democrats are running away from him. The Washington Post and the New York Times, as Liz points out, are running away from him. But it isn't his policies, it's his age. Did you see him on the climate change thing? He was in outside of Boston, Monica. The setting was so ugly. It looked like a Ukrainian battlefield. They stuck him in a Ukrainian battlefield, and because it's hot out, it's in the 90s. Therefore, climate change is terrible and it's destroying everything. And here we go again. No more fossil fuels in 5 years or whatever. So, is it his policies or his age?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, Larry, about the location where he gave this climate change speech. I thought the exact same thing. It was all like industrial behind him. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't nature. It looked really bizarre. Yeah. And I thought, you know, where is his advance team? Advance teams are supposed to go and scout out a great location. The whole White House is falling apart. Look, I think when it comes to all of these articles that we're seeing a spate of things out there about Biden's advancing age and his inability now to do the job. None of this is a coincidence. The propaganda press helped to get him elected because they knew that he would be a malleable puppet for the powers that be, the left-wing power brokers that wanted to ram all of the socialist nonsense through. So they they knew that they could work around Biden and just have him there as sort of a figurehead around which all of the socialist agenda would rotate. Now you're getting these cases, not a coincidence. It is because the left-wing power brokers have decided that the useful idiot has outlived his usefulness. And so they now want to use his age as a pretext to remove him. And that's why you're seeing all of this percolate up right now.
Look, at if first of all, they should have had him in front of a big wind turbine. All right, that would have been very cool. Like, take that Ukrainian battlefield setting that they had. They should have stuck a wind turbine in there. But then the problem is the wind turbines are always killing birds. So you're going to have endangered species.
You could have had a dead bird drop on his head.
I know.
That might be the end of the climate agenda.
Look, I can't say. We have these meetings in the Oval with President Trump, former President Trump. And, and the subject of climate change would come up. And the first thing he'd always say, he said, well, I'm not against wind turbines, but they're killing all the birds. They're killing all the birds. And then he'd go on this little riff for about 6 or 7 minutes about how we had to save the birds. But I do think that's a problem. And by the way, isn't it, Liz, didn't they try to put wind turbines in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard?
Yeah.
And Senator Kennedy and all those people said, no to wind turbines?
Not in my backyard, not in my sound, right? Of course. And by the way, it's still going on. The fight goes on today, not only because, of course, no one wants to look out their window at the beautiful ocean and see wind turbines, but also, they do kill birds. And also, it means the cost of electricity would go through the roof. That's what is never talked about, Larry. And there is this view that if you just keep telling Americans that we're going to transfer to renewable energy, it's going to be wonderful, and there's no cost. I mean, that's kind of the message, right? Plug in your electric car, and there's no cost to you. You don't have to pay $5 a gallon for gasoline. Lucky you, because there's no cost. Well, of course there's a cost. And as we see in Europe now, the cost can be 2-3, now in Germany, 6 times as much as it is here for electricity. That message has got to get out, that there is a cost. But yes, wind turbines off the coast of Cape Cod basically bit the dust because of a Ted Kennedy, which is a wonderful hypocritical move.
And John Kerry, isn't he a big deal out there someplace?
Yeah.
I mean, Mr. Global Warming. So, Monica, it's hot out. Okay, it's very hot. All right, it's 95 in New York City. We're in a little hot. Therefore, here's the logic, Monica. It's hot outside. Therefore, we have to end fossil fuels. Is there anything wrong with that logic?
It's hot outside because it's July. It's called summer. Okay.
Yes.
And with the climate change, it's called God. Okay. listen, the conversation about wind turbines, there's a story in the last 24 hours that a wind turbine caught fire and it actually spilled about 12,000 gallons of, guess what? Oil.
Ooh.
Because these wind turbines require oil, fossil fuels, to operate. Just like EVs require electricity, which in turn requires coal, requires fossil fuels to do all of this so-called green energy.
Well,
so, look, I've made this point on your show multiple times, Larry, and I make it everywhere I can. The reason the left continues to attack the U.S. energy sector is because the energy sector is the biggest of them all, meaning it is the biggest lever available to them to pull to effectuate the fundamental transformation of the nation. If they can re-engineer the U.S. economy toward a more socialist, Marxist kind of model, a collectivist kind of model, then they will go on to transform the entire country. So they took a step back and said, how best to do it? Yes, they have small businesses under attack. They're trying to crush those. They're trying to crush all kinds of industries. But the way that they do it, the root of all of this, is going after the U.S. energy sector. That is why they continue their relentless march. Yes, they may have some top-line concern about the environment or climate, but that's not what's really driving them. If they really cared, like John Kerry and the rest of these clowns, they would not be on private jets every 5 minutes. They would want those wind turbines in the ocean, in their backyard, but they don't. They're not hypocrites. This is hierarchy. This is the ruling class trying to effectuate a major ideological and economic change.
You know who put this out many months ago? Last year, 2021, Steve Forbes said modern socialism, it doesn't take, you don't have to take over the means of production, you know, like Joe Stalin in the 30s and all that. What modern socialism is through the regulatory state. That's how they're trying to do it. Now, the EPA decision by the Supreme Court is going to really slow that down or maybe even stop it out. But before we take a break, I want to ask Liz Peek, have you ever had oil like on your windshield where you had to have windshield wipers and to take the oil away? And then at this, and then 20 minutes later, you had melanoma on your nose. I mean, that's the analysis that Biden said the other day.
Yeah, another puzzler from our president. No, I've never seen an oil slick on the windshield. And by the way, who knew that Delaware was the most polluted state in the country? I'm sure they're trying to live down that reputational hit from the president. I always thought, frankly, New Jersey was, without wanting to impugn New Jerseyites. Anyway. No, you know, another strange wanderings.
Do you think Biden, with this, he has COVID, and we all wish him well. I mean, but did he, when he did that appearance, I didn't see much difference, COVID or non-COVID.
No, it's true. Stuart Varney was asking about, you know, do we think there might be some brain fog? How would you know? I mean, you know, brain fog in Biden is like an everyday event. It's like the Nantucket Harbor. Lots of fog.
I'm with you, Monica. You know, when you set up these presidential appearances, you really want them to look nice with flags and some symbolic thing in the background. That was looked like a very bad post-Ukrainian battle. That's the way I looked at that. And if he's going to sell...
I did too. I did too, Larry, and I immediately thought about, well, there must be no advance team on top of no communications team. We know that this White House has hemorrhaged their communication staff, very high turnover, people fleeing the scene of the accident. So there is nobody there, really, to micromanage this stuff or to think ahead. And when you've got a president who can't do it, and then you don't have a team around him who could pick up the slack, we are in a very precarious position.
Well, that's the thing. Everything he does goes bad. I mean, it's just a Jimmy Carter kind of story here. Everything he does goes bad, looks bad, says bad. You know, they cannot get out of this box they put themselves in. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about heroic Bernie Sanders, who voted against the $250 billion CHIPS bill, the semiconductor bill, and ask, why are Republicans voting for it? We have Liz Peek and Monica Crowley. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. We're talking money and politics with Liz Peek, Fox News contributor, syndicated columnist, and Monica Crowley, former assistant treasury secretary, and the Monica Crowley podcast. She won't invite me on, but it's okay. It's not a problem. I don't take it personally.
Not true.
Can we talk about this insane $250 billion pork barrel industrial policy, picking winners and losers, inflationary subsidies to the semiconductor industry? And I say, you know, all kidding aside, Bernie Sanders voted against it on all the right grounds, by the way. But 16 Republicans voted for the procedural vote, and they seem bound and determined to vote for this bill. And to me, Liz, I'll start with you on this. This really undercuts the GOP position on, you know, they had the fiscal high ground. The GOP had been running against big spending and deficit spending and money printing and so forth. And here they go, and nobody whispers any pay-fors for this. I mean, it's all the Democratic agenda, and 16 GOP senators voted for it. And I don't get it. I mean, I just don't understand how this is possible.
I agree with you, and I have been really opposed to this bill, mainly because it is indeed corporate handouts that we're talking about. Corporate handouts, by the way, to an industry that is one of the most profitable on Earth, that has experienced a multi-year surge in business. It's all about trying to get semiconductor companies to build plants and manufacture here in the U.S. Okay, well, that's terrific, but the truth is most of the major manufacturers have already committed to building plants in the United States for very good reason. Most of their biggest customers are here, and by the way, a lot of them are headquartered now producing heavily in Taiwan, where there are fighter jets buzzing their plants day and night. So it's a little bit a survival tactic to move out of Taiwan. It makes sense for them to come here, where we have a trained workforce, where the industry began, by the way. And so I think it's a completely unnecessary package to offer. Now, I don't know what other countries are offering these companies. Intel, for example, are they getting huge bids from other companies to build there? I don't know, but they've already broken ground on a plant. So it seems to me then holding your hand out for a big paycheck from the government just seems kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. You know, Monica, we had Senator Rick Scott on earlier in the program, who's very much opposed to it for many of the reasons Liz just mentioned. But I just wonder politically, does this hurt the Republican high ground on fiscal policy? Does this undermine their march towards taking back the Senate in November?
I think it does, Larry. And, you know, the old line about the Republican Party, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Hmm. And the other line is that the Democratic Party is the evil party and the Republican Party is the stupid party. Hmm. Well, I think this pretty much bears that out. And there is going to be a political cost for these 16 Senate Republicans who profess to be fiscal conservatives going down this road of corporate welfare. They argue a good game against it, but when push comes to shove, they're still voting for it. And by the way, a lot of them had coverage from other Senate Republicans, their colleagues who voted against it, like Ted Cruz and others. So in this list of 16, there are the usual suspects like Romney, Murkowski, Collins, but then some that surprised me, like Portman and Hagerty. I don't know why they wanted to do this unless they just wanted to bring some dollars home to their states. But I want to make a bigger point here. I am all for bringing the supply chain back to the U.S., bringing manufacturing back. This is a national security issue as well as an economic one, Larry. But the way President Trump did it was with a carrot and a stick. So the stick was tariffs on China and renegotiating trade deals with our key trading partners, including our North American ones, China, Japan, South Korea, and so on. So he had the stick. And then the carrot was tax cuts and regulatory relief here at home to get companies to bring their operations back, create jobs here at home. And the end result was President Trump was able to bring back over 500,000 manufacturing jobs, whether it's semiconductors or anything else. That's how he got it done, rather than this kind of out of control federal spending that way too many Republicans are sanctioning here.
You know, Liz, to that point, to Monica's point, why not focus on reducing the tax cost of doing business here? Extend the Trump tax cuts, extend the 100% immediate expensing, make R&D credits 100% expensed in the first year. Those are the things that, first of all, have very little cost and very high return and will make the U.S. the most hospitable investment climate. I mean, don't spend your way. Just provide incentives to come here. That's what's missing from this conversation.
Yeah, I think you and Monica make a very good point. Unfortunately, that's just not the Democrat playbook, and that is still what's driving this bill. By the way, the initial form of this bill, the initial shape of it was 2,900 pages. And yes, it did have this $50 billion for the semiconductor industry. It had hundreds of billions of dollars for things like climate change and the PRO Act. Pro-labor union policies were also buried in this bill. I think that's part of the answer. They love these big 1,000, 2,000 page bills because it allows them to hide a lot of things that they want to get done and they can't really vote on independently because they're not very popular. So they sneak the Green New Deal into the American Competes Act. That's what's in this bill. So, you know, I think you make a lot of sense, but guess what? That's not what drives our politics.
No, and Monica, there's another $50 billion slush fund for the Energy Department.
Yep.
So this is Solyndra to the 20th power. I mean, Solyndra, the Energy Department, and by the way, same with the Commerce Department, they're not really Energy and Commerce Departments. They're hedge funds, Monica. They're hedge funds where they're investing in things, you know, and they're all doomed to fail. I mean, that was what we learned with Solyndra.
Yeah, the taxpayers were on the hook with Solyndra for what, 300? Was it 300 million or over a billion? I forget the exact amount, but the taxpayers had to eat that. And it's all of this kind of energy experimentation that the left wants to do. And again, I get back to the much bigger point, Larry, about all of this, which is they continue to focus on the remaking of American society and life, the reengineering of the U.S. economy. The Democrats are not about policies that actually work for the American people. President Trump was. He delivered for them lower taxes, regulatory relief, fairer trade deals, unleashing our great energy sector. The Democrats are not about any of that. They don't care about whether or not these policies work. All of their policies are designed with a bigger intent in mind, which is this fundamental transformation of the nation. They don't care about how much money they spend. In fact, they want to spend more. They want to waste more, A, in service of this ideological plan that they've got, but also to implode the system. You know, this is what all of this is about. They are overwhelming the economic system. They're overwhelming the border. They're overwhelming everything in every direction in order to destroy it so they can rebuild it in a socialist model.
But Liz, the big hero here is Bernie Sanders. He voted against it.
Who would have thunk it, right?
He voted against it. By the way, I had Bill Hagerty on the TV show. He's a really good man, and he's a good conservative. And I just kind of tried politely to, I had to go after him. And he said the bill would have help permitting. All right. Well, I'm all for permitting. I mean, the NEC wrote the NEPA permitting reforms, but this bill is not about permitting.
No.
I mean, that's the trouble here. This is just a step backwards. I don't know. Maybe they'll change their minds, some of these guys, and defeat it. Anyway, you're both great. Liz Peek, thank you very much. Monica Crowley, thank you very much. Folks, we're going to take a break, and on the other side of the break, we are going to do some stock market work. Hang around with us. Are we heading into recession? Sure looks like it.
It's the Larry Kudlow Show. Free market prosperity starts here. Now, here's Larry Kudlow.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Join us during the week, Fox Business. The name of the show is Kudlow, 4 to 5 p.m. every day. And you can live stream us here on the radio. Go on the internet, WABCradio.com or LarryKudlowShow.com. And you can pick us up all over the country and around the world and throughout the solar system. Unless China takes Mars. China is aiming at Mars. That's not good. But anyway, we've got Michelle Girard, head U.S. economist for NatWest Markets, and Mike Ozanian, assisting managing editor, Forbes Media, and co-host of Forbes Sports Money on the YES Network. Mike Ozanian, Yanks lost another pitcher last night. It's not good.
It's not good. I think our rotation is still pretty deep. We don't have Severino, but I still think we're in pretty good shape. We'll see what happens. We'll see how Armand does. If he can rebound and get back into the rotation stronger. Good thing is we're in good shape. Looks like we'll get a bye in that first round, be one of the top two teams, which means if you get into the best out of five or best out of seven, you may only need three starters. So call me the eternal optimist. It's funny, you listen to the sports talk radio and Yankee fans are going hyperbolic at, you know, they can't beat the Astros and we've got a couple of injuries, you know. But you know, if you would have asked me before the season started, would I take where we are right now? I would have signed up immediately.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't even think we'd win the division at the beginning of the year, quite frankly. I thought Toronto looked stronger. And, you know, Tampa Bay is always strong, the epitome of a money ball team with that low payroll. But, you know, here we sit, and we have perhaps the MVP of the league in Aaron Judge.
Yeah, he's
and our bullpen's been great throughout almost the entire season. So, you know, look, once the playoffs start and once you get to September and October, it's often who's the hottest team, right, Larry? We saw that with the Braves last year. The first half of the year, they did nothing. Then they came and just stormed right through the postseason. So I think we're in good shape, and we'll see how healthy we are once the playoffs start, and I think that'll probably be the key.
Michelle, forgive us, but I can't help myself when I have Mike Ozanian, who's just the best.
No, we're Yankees fans as well.
Oh,
watching
good.
The captain, we're all in for sure. So,
by the way, Mike, DJ LeMahieu's really coming on now. That's very important.
He is. He's going
really
back to how
on.
He was a couple of years ago.
That's right.
And that
he gets
that's
on
a huge key.
Right, he gets on base and Judge hits a home run. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I watched it last night. I saw both homers. It was really something. It was a lot of fun. So, Michelle, I don't want you to feel ignored because we love you. And I'm just going to ask you a simple question. We're going to get the GDP report when, Thursday or Friday?
Yeah.
And are we in a recession? It's going to be a second negative quarter?
Is the economy as healthy as the Yankees? I was thinking as you were going forward,
right.
As we were talking. I mean, I think this report's going to be important. We, you know, obviously because after Friday's very disappointing data, globally as well as in the U.S., the recession fears have, again, growth fears have moved to the fore. And so, you know, we go into looking for this GDP report on Thursday with – we already have a negative print in Q1. Now, that print is very misleading because in the first quarter, you had a big drag from trade, some of the volatile categories, and actually underlying you know, private consumption and investment looked good. But the bottom line is we've got a negative quarter in Q1, and in the second quarter, the consensus is looking for a gain of only 0.7%. We're a bit stronger at 1.5%. But it's the flip side. I mean, it looks better on the headline. Underlying doesn't look so good. And the point I was only making is when you're looking at numbers that low, sort of anything can happen. You could get another negative print. And that will, you know, talk about hyperbolic. I mean, that will the talk of recession if you, you know, have two back-to-back negative quarters. That isn't the official definition of recession, but it's always kind of a rule of thumb. And I think that, you know, that's what people will be watching for. I don't think we're in a recession. I actually think the underlying economy absolutely has cooled, but consumers in particular have shown a little bit more resilience. I'm more worried about recession in 2023 than I am that we're in a recession now. But again, getting back to this week will be important because of the focus on just, you know, on where we exactly stand and is the economy actually, you know, continuing to grow or have we already slipped?
I mean, it looks like, you're right. The C plus I was pretty strong in Q1.
Right.
But that looks lousy now. I mean, real wages are falling and real retail sales are falling. Manufacturing last 2 months fell.
Yep.
And I think we're in the front end of a recession, but
yeah.
It doesn't look good. Business equipment, we'll see what that comes out, but the reports from these Fed regional surveys are very discouraging.
Very discouraging. So they're looking at just private sector consumption and investment. We grew 3% in the first quarter, and we're going to be down to around 1% in the second quarter. So definitely a downshift there. And as you said, looking ahead, the setup isn't positive. The surveys themselves, if you look at surveys in the regional reports on plans to spend, you know, to invest going forward, it suggests
we've got capital spending flat in the second quarter, and given what businesses are saying about how they're not going to be spending and investing going forward, I would expect that will turn negative as we move into the second half of the year. And I think even the resilience of the consumer, I think, reflects some pent-up spending or spending in the pipeline. I keep saying I think people made a lot of plans this summer to travel and to do things, having not been able to do so the last couple of years. And they were going to take those trips because, again, they hadn't been able to, and they were looking forward to it. But when you think about what spending isn't in the pipeline and new spending, if you will, you know, are we going to plan another big trip next year? Are we going to, you know, the holiday shopping season? I think consumers are going, you know, the concern they have about the outlook will show itself, and you will see more conservative behavior. And so I that's what I'm saying. I think I would agree with you, a great way to characterize it. I think we're on the front end of what will ultimately be, I think, probably a dip into a downturn.
And Mike Ozanian, let us assume the Fed raises 75 basis points in their meeting on Wednesday. But what is the people are talking about? We've seen peak inflation, but is inflation really going to come down? Because you could be setting up what Milton Friedman said many years ago, inflationary recession. I mean, the fact that we're in recession does not mean we've solved inflation necessarily.
I think that the rate of inflation could go down a little bit, but it's still going to be high and problematic. I do think, though, the focus ahead is shifting from rising inflation to a slowdown or a recession in the economy. I think you're seeing that with the inverted yield curve. You're seeing that with consumers, in terms of over a third of them now saying that you know, they're having trouble meeting their bills. You're seeing it in earnings revisions where you have that are dependent on consumer spending, like Darden Restaurants, which just drastically lowered its earnings revisions for this year. So I think that's the bigger potential downfall to the stock market and investors, is really the economy right now. If it does what it's saying it's going to do in terms of reducing its balance sheet, you're seeing what that's doing to the housing market. Lots of bad news there with mortgage rates, with housing starts. So I think the consumer is being hurt. You already mentioned real wages. We also saw it with the national income accounts, with corporate profits. Those are down on an annualized rate in the first quarter. Productivity was down significantly in the first quarter. So I think the focus really now is on the economy, as the Fed at least tries to lower interest rate, raises interest rates to lower inflation. The economy is really my biggest concern right now.
All right, let's take a quick break. We have plenty of time going ahead. We got Michelle Girard, head U.S. economist for NatWest Markets, and Mike Ozanian from Forbes and Sports Money on the YES Network. Because here, I want to think about this for the next seg. The Fed's going to jack up 75 basis points, and the GDP report the next day is not going to be good. It could be flat, it could be negative. It's not going to be good. So is the Fed going to get blamed for this whole thing? And will Jay Powell continue with his inflationary manhood, growing hair on his chest, or is he going to back off after this? I'll be right back. I'm Kudlow. We'll be right back.
Now, back to the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're talking stocks. Michelle Girard, head U.S. economist for NatWest. Mike Ozanian, assistant managing editor, Forbes Media, co-host of Forbes Sports Money on the YES Network. And by the by, stocks did go up this past week. The Dow was up 611. NASDAQ up 382. The S&P 500 up 98. The S&P benchmark is now down 17% year to date. So it's bear market territory, if not exactly a bear market. Mike, so I just want to continue this. The Fed's going to jack up rates by 75 bips, I guess. And then the next day there's going to be a recession report or close to it. What kind of position does that put the Fed in? Will they keep their anti-inflation manhood?
I think they will, but I think that their manhood is misplaced, if you will. I think their manhood has been, first of all, they were late to the game. Secondly, I think they've used the wrong formula. I think instead of focusing on interest rates, they should have been focusing on the money supply. Mm-hmm. All they had to do was open the notes to see Paul Volcker's playbook that began in the late 70s and then, of course, in the early 80s, where he focused on the money supply growth rather than interest rates. He let the market set interest rates. And he realized if he got the money supply down, he would be able to get inflation down. This Fed doesn't seem to understand that. And that's why, going back to your point on the earlier segment, I don't think inflation is dead. I don't think they have the remedy for it. And I think with their interest rate policy, look, the flash report from the Atlanta Fed is for, I think it's a 2.5% or 2.3% decline in second quarter GDP.
1.6.
They have a great track record.
1.6.
Great track record. Q2 and then was it 2.1% in Q2 and 1.6 in Q1? Or is it reversed?
It's actually, the flash is minus 1.6 as of July 19th. Yeah. And that actually is the same. First quarter was minus 1.6. I think that's right, Michelle.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Michelle, I'm going to ask, it's unfair to say, but what is Wall Street thinking about inflation? I'm really more interested in what you're thinking because you're smarter than Wall Street.
No, but like Mike said, I mean, it has shifted, right? I do think that the market has shifted from its concerns about inflation to concerns about recession, and they think recession will help on the inflation front. And so, you know, you can, if you look at pricing for the Fed, markets do expect the Fed to continue to raise interest rates through this year, but are anticipating they'll have to reverse course and cut rates in 2023 because the economy will have slowed or slipped into an outright recession. I just don't think it's going to be so straightforward. I think it's going to be very challenging for the Fed. I mean, Larry, you've been right. We had thought we'd see the peak in inflation. I had thought we'd see the peak high numbers two months ago. It's gone a bit further. I always thought, though, that inflation, like you, was going to be more persistent. I mean, I think it'll come down. Mm. I don't think it's going to come down to where they need it to come down. And so, if I look ahead, I think the Fed is going to face a really difficult decision. I mean, it's one thing to raise interest rates when you're just trying to get to neutral. The economy is growing, albeit more slowly. It's a whole different ballgame when you're already sort of above neutral into restrictive. The economy is much, much weaker, if not in recession, and yet inflation is not where you need it to be. And is, you know, it's north of even 3%. Now what do you do? Now are you committed to your 2% and you continue to raise interest rates, even though mm-hmm. it may mean, obviously putting the economy into a much more challenging position? Do you back off and undermine your credit? I think the Fed is going to be very challenged as we get into 2023. And I think the decisions they've had to make this year are going to seem like nothing, or, you know, the challenges that they've faced, I think, are going to be like nothing compared to what I think they may face next year.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically the Fed is screwed. They're in trouble because what you say, so let's say the absolute underlying base inflation rate. I like to look at the Cleveland Fed trimmed mean, mm-hmm. where they chop off the highest 8% prices and the lowest 8% prices. And that number now is 7% inflation.
Right.
All right, so 7% is less than 9.1, which I think was the last CPI. But 7% is more than three times their target of 2.
Right.
And that's the problem they're going to have. And recessions don't necessarily. I mean, Mike Ozanian, here you're talking about the money supply and inferring the monetary base, and all that has slowed down markedly after booming. I mean, lags are long and variable. It's kind of hard to figure. It's not an exact relationship. But they haven't really taken the balance sheet down. The money supply has stopped the last few months. Commodities are down. And the CRB futures I watch is down about, 25%, although it's still way above where it was 2 years ago. I mean, that's the dilemma, Mike. The Fed is going to have to keep raising rates, even though I sort of agree with you that the rate obsession is not good, but they're going to have to keep doing it while the economy is in recession. That's very tricky.
Right. I agree. And I go back and I say they got themselves into this mess with all the quantitative easing that they did in this, and how big. I think its balance sheet grew tenfold since 2007 or something like that. I mean, it just, they put themselves in an enormous bind. And I think really the real warning sign of this was when we were coming out of the pandemic and reversing from that, they still kept their foot on the accelerator. And I think that was the point. I mean, everything was kind of set at that point. We had had the Trump tax cuts, and we had had the easing of certain regulations that had been making it difficult on businesses. And they just should have let us just come out of the pandemic. People were coming back to work. Businesses were opening up. Things were perfect, and they just kept going. And I don't understand why. But they did, and then you continued to have a rapid increase in the money supply at that point, and the Fed kept increasing its balance sheet, and I think that's why they're behind the eight ball right now, and I think that's why it's going to be very, very difficult for them going forward to slow down inflation without getting us into a serious recession.
You know, Michelle, there's a big story in New York Post today. Larry Summers, who's been so good on inflation and critiquing federal spending and Federal Reserve easing. But now he says we got to raise taxes. Now's the time to raise taxes. Really? What a terrific idea. I would cut taxes to solve inflation. That's what Reagan did.
Well, don't you have to, right? Because we all know it's all about not just the demand side of the economy, but obviously the supply side. And the Fed now does have to – it's limited. Everybody keeps saying, oh, the Fed can't solve the supply problem, the problem with the supply side. And that's true. So they're focused on trying to cool demand to bring supply and demand into balance. But what you'd exactly like to see is fiscal policy helping out on the other side by helping in terms of increasing incentives to increase output, to increase supply by actually, you know, cutting taxes. So you're, you know, when you think about the policy mix, you know, that you're going to need and how we can help to get the Fed and the economy out of what is going to be this very difficult situation, tricky situation we all recognize, you're exactly right. I mean, the exact thing you wouldn't want to be doing would be to be raising, you know, raising taxes. The other thing I just was going to point out, too, is the other thing that the markets are dealing with is you know, after a decade of the Fed rushing in to support markets. Anytime the markets get worried about anything, the Fed rushes in either with easier policy or, you know, with programs to support, you know, buying of treasury securities to support the markets. What's also happening right now is the Fed can't do that, and the market is having to adjust. And I'm talking actually more about the fixed income market, where you've got incredible amounts of volatility and honestly unprecedented illiquidity. I mean, there are days in the screens that, you know, there's no bids for the 20-year, as there's been a lot of talks about. I mean, the Fed is, you're losing a big support or a big buyer in the market, and the market is having to learn how to stand on its own again, which it hasn't had to do for over a decade, because the Fed was always quick to rush in. When there's volatility, they could smooth it over, talk friendly. They can't do that now.
Hang on. Can you guys go a third segment?
Yep.
All right.
I'm fine. Yep.
Yeah. Michelle Gerard, the last supply-sider on Wall Street, and Mike Ozanian. I'm Kavo. We're going to run a third segment because they're so good. We'll talk some investment strategy. What is the poor average investor going to do about all this? I'm Larry Kudlow. We'll be right back.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. We're here going longer with two experts on the markets and the strategy for investors. Michelle Gerard, head economist, head U.S. economist, NatWest Markets. Mike Ozanian, assistant managing editor, Forbes Media, and co-host of Sports Money on the YES Network. Mike Ozanian, what does an investor do? What does a poor, average, typical investor do who's kind of gotten hosed so far this year in their 401ks and their IRAs for their retirement? What do you do here?
Maybe look at a sector that's going to get whipsawed, for example, like the banking sector, right? Focus is generally on the big banks and looking at the entire group as one collective. And, you know, everyone's talking about write-offs at banks, J.P. Morgan, and so forth. Well, you know, within that, maybe you could cherry pick. So, you know, my best idea is East West Bancorp, ticker symbol EWBC. They're a small bank, $10 billion market cap, but they have a very, very clean balance sheet, expectations for write-offs, very minimal, strong earnings growth. So maybe take something there that in a sector that is out of favor right now and play that stock. And then, you know, I happen to be, maybe call me a revolutionary, but I happen to think this country still needs energy to prosper. So I'm going to, and even fossil fuels, if I'm allowed to say that. But so I'll go with, I still love Chevron. I've mentioned them before on your show, but I think they're an extremely well-managed company. And I think it's a great, great long-term bet.
Mike, don't you know, because it's 95 degrees out today, that we have to end fossil fuels? We have to end fossil fuels because it's hot. It's hot out. I mean, the fact that it's July has no meaning to the Bidens. It's hot out, and therefore it's global warming, and we have to end fossil fuels in 5 years. I thought you knew that.
Right. Well, that, and I'm, we're going to get rid of fertilizer so we all starve. So do those two things, and there you have it.
Really? I mean, I was talking about that with Monica Crowley and Liz Peek. They set this poor guy up in a setting Wednesday on his global warming. It looked like a Ukrainian battlefield. That's point number one. Then he says he's got cancer, and when he was driving around Delaware, he had oil on his windshield. I mean, really? I mean, that was the sum total of his event for climate change. I don't really think that worked out. I mean, I think that just did not really work out. Michelle, why are interest rates kept falling this week? The 2 year, really, 2 years down 15 bips, 5 years down 19 bips, 10 years down 16 bips, et cetera, et cetera. What is that all about?
Yeah, I mean, as we talked about, I think, you know, with especially the weak data as, you know, on Thursday and Friday, I mean, we had the weak housing data, as Mike mentioned. I mean, you know, that you can see the impact that higher mortgage rates are having on housing. The claims numbers suggested the labor market may be weakening up. And then on Friday, we had evidence with the PMIs, the surveys for both services falling into contraction territory, and services have been a relative bright spot. Manufacturing, they weakened up. I mean, the fears of recession is really what drove yields lower. But, you know, you made that statement earlier that recession doesn't necessarily solve the inflation problem.
Right.
The markets don't put that together. Right now, as you see the growth fears move to the fore, that it's because they think that the turn down in the economy will solve the inflation problem. And again, the expectation is that it'll force the Fed to reverse course. They won't be able, not only will they not be able to keep hiking, but event, you know, sooner rather than later, they'll end up having to cut rates. You know, and I just think, you know, as I said, looking ahead, I think it's going to be, you know, the market is going to have a real rethink on this when, you know, you do see the economy much weaker. But the Fed, because inflation doesn't give them, inflation isn't following suit like the market thinks it will, and the Fed actually has to potentially keep going. That's not even something that the Fed, you know, that the markets have on their radar screen, that you could have this stagflationary situation. The market is at the moment is just assuming as this data gets weaker, the economy goes into recession. You know, again, we can rethink what our outlook for the, you know, for the Fed. And I, you know, again, I think we've come too far with this move for exactly the reasons we've talked about.
But look at all these interest rates. Take the 10-year note at 2.75 or the 5, or the 2-year note. 2-year note is under 3% now. But Michelle, every yield is way below inflation. Real rates are way below. You own bonds, you're getting killed right now.
Right, exactly.
I mean, how long can that last?
Yeah, I just think that it's, you know, there's an expectation that the inflation numbers are not going to stay at these levels sustainably. And I will say, you know, like I think we all agree, that I do believe they will move down. I just don't think they're going to come down as fast and as far as the market thinks. And therefore, you know, I don't think that these levels are, you know, are sustainable. Like I said, I don't think it's, they're attractive. I don't think that they'll stay low. I think we're going to continue to have a lot of upward pressure on interest rates because I think the Fed is going to have to continue to fight this battle a lot longer and harder than I think the markets expect.
And then Michael Zanin, I want to come back to Larry Summers. It's time to raise taxes. You know, in the Reagan years, Mike, the prescription from people like Art Laffer and Robert Mundell and others was tax cuts and tight money.
Right.
The Fed should keep the money supply low, keep the dollar high, king dollar, and cut tax rates. So you have slower money growth chasing even more goods. Now, what Summers is saying is we should have slower money growth chasing fewer goods. I mean, I don't see why that's not counterinflationary. That actually could be inflationary.
It's backwards. And I think what I get when I tune in and watch, and when I watch your show on the Fox Business Channel, it's economic analysis. When I tune into a lot of other shows and other channels to try to see what, you know, what's the buzz is, if you will, it's all very political. And the fact of the matter is, this is not a political issue, or should it not be? Forget about Reagan and Volcker. Go back to Kennedy and his tax cuts. He was a Democrat, yet he understood the basic economic principles and understood, as Michelle has pointed out, she used the word incentive. That's vital to a pro-growth economy, and that's what people seem to be missing. You know, look, at the end of the day, I'd much rather have more money in the hands of the great entrepreneurs and small business owners of this country than I would in the hands of politicians. And that's the simple choice of it all. I mean, that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. And the results of our history have shown us that when the incentives are there and we're putting more money, the marginal return that you can earn on each additional investment of capital, if you increase that, you will get the investment and you will get the growth. We've always seen that. The playbook is there. Why there's such pushback to that, I can only surmise this has become, by and large, a political debate, which it should not be, in my opinion.
Well, I wrote a book on that subject, JFK and the Reagan Revolution, tax cuts and sound money. But Kennedy's tax cuts, you know, unleashed over, I mean, he was assassinated horribly, but the aftermath was about 5% growth and virtually no inflation.
He insisted
on keeping the dollar linked to gold. So the dollar's value was good. And tax cuts lowered inflation. And the Reagan watchword was tax cuts and tight money, which was exactly what JFK tried to do. I mean, Mike, you listen to Michelle Girard? She's the last supply-sider on Wall Street. Listen to her. I mean, really, it's wonderful to hear.
I would argue that the boom put forth with Reagan and Volcker actually lasted well into the 90s. And that's how
absolutely.
Just like you mentioned how long the Kennedy boom lasted, the Reagan boom lasted into the 90s. And then somehow we got everything backwards and it all became political. The Fed has become far, far, far too powerful in my opinion. As witnessed by the size of their balance sheet. And this has got to be reversed. The trend's got to go back to the way it was to achieve long-term prosperity.
Right. You two are great. Michelle, I won't say anything more. I don't want to get you into trouble. But you're doing great. You have maintained your bearings all these years. God bless.
I was taught well.
Michelle Girard of NatWest Markets, Mike Ozanian of Forbes Media, and Sports Money on Yes Network. You two are fabulous. Folks, I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to try to find Congressman Lee Zeldin, who is still alive. God bless. He's still healthy. But this Hochul governor's got to be whooped. And his would-be assassin is let loose, and that's got to stop, too. Anyway, I'm Larry Kudlow. We're going to take a break. Other side of the break, we'll find Congressman Lee Zeldin.
From Wall Street to the White House, this is the Larry Kudlow Show.
Welcome back, folks. I'm Larry Kudlow. Great pleasure. We're going to bring my pal, Congressman Lee Zeldin, House member, Republican candidate for governor against Kathy Hochul. Lee, first of all, you're safe and sound. Thank heavens. That's all to the good. But I'm reading. I want to get your take on this story that's developing. Only hours before this attempted assassination, Hochul apparently put out a press advisory, a very inflammatory press advisory, first of all, publishing your schedule, and then second of all, calling you an extremist who was peddling lies, misinformation, and far-right agenda. So, I mean, she actually opened the door to this thing, it seems to me.
And on top of that, I've heard about this media advisory. On top of it, there was also emails that were sent out by her campaign staffers to Democrats in the area, stirring them up and then giving exact time, date, location of where particular rallies were. That, you know, this Thursday evening rally was the first stop of what's been a statewide tour all day yesterday, all day today, all day tomorrow, all throughout the state. Obviously, security ramped up yesterday morning. But as we've been going to these different stops, we're being met up by her protesters. And that came from an event a little while ago where a whole bunch of her people were. They're following us from stop to stop with this box car with my name and face and rhetoric on this this box car going after us. So, I mean, they didn't even decide to take it easy for a few days and just, you know, park the box car in some driveway and say, maybe we'll try this again in 2 weeks. So I listen, political violence has no place in our country. I don't care what side of the aisle you are, what your registration, the candidate you're supporting. We settle our scores at the ballot box, not through political violence. It's been an interesting few days here on the trail.
Well, Lee, look, you're a strong guy. And again, thank heavens you were able to stop this. But I'm going to say that she is partly culpable for this, okay? Somebody should do an investigation. She crossed the line. I mean, I'm reading this press advice. I'm reading reporters. Let's hear. Very unusual advisory from Kathy Hochul just now, basically making fun of Lee Zeldin by mocking his campaign schedule this weekend and replacing his events with Democratic talking points about Donald Trump. She is blasting you as some kind of extremist, which has never been true in your career. You're a common sense guy. And publishing your schedule. I mean, what is up with that? This is worse than what they – well, look, with Brett Kavanaugh, they found this kid who was trying to murder him. But with you, the guy actually went and took actions to try to murder you, and now he's outside on the loose once again, and Hochul has no response to that. I mean, this is an she is so corrupt, it's beyond belief.
She is corrupt. The stories came out, one of them this week, where somebody provided a family hundreds of thousands of dollars to her campaign account. And then the governor does a no-bid contract of several hundreds of millions of dollars. And in New York, we have competitive bidding process. So you might say, well, how is it possible that she got around the law? Well, every 30 days, she unilaterally signs off on extending her COVID emergency powers without getting permission from the legislature. And with that, she then claims a power that allows her to say, I'm not going to do competitive bidding. I'm just going to be able to give this campaign donor hundreds of millions of dollars. It's insane. It should be investigated. I actually called on the attorney general's office to open up an investigation on that. And on top of it all, as you were talking about some of these other issues that the governor wants to focus on, I've been focused on the issues that matter most to New Yorkers. I've been talking about crime and economy. I had just released a new campaign ad where I was talking about crime and Jose Alba and Alvin Bragg, the need for him to go, as well as cashless bail to be repealed. And then this happened where right after the attack, the guy got immediately released due to New York's cashless bail law.
How is that possible? How is that possible?
They passed this law that states that all sorts of different offenses, you have no discretion as a judge or a prosecutor to be able to keep someone behind bars, even if you feel like they are a danger to society. and that there are flight risks based on their past criminal record, the seriousness of the offense, all these different factors. It doesn't matter if there's a particular charge that they're being hit with. If it's not bail eligible, you can't ask for it. And as a consequence, on top of what just happened with this guy who tried stabbing me a couple nights ago, a couple weeks ago, there were two people busted in New York, two Mexican cartel drug smugglers caught with $1.2 million worth of crystal meth, and they were not able to put bail on these two guys.
Mm. Oh, my God. You know, Andy McCarthy's got a column out, another angle on this attempt on your life. You are a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. This is a federal crime to try to attack you. And the Justice Department should be prosecuting this, the Democrat, you know, Merrick Garland. But, of course, they're not. But as a House, you can't go and an attempt to murder House members, I don't care what party you're in, and not be prosecuted for that? I mean, this is part of the national crime problem.
Yeah, I know that there have been communications on the security front with the Capitol Police. I can't speak to whether or not there have been any conversations with the U.S. attorney or the DOJ, the AG, with regards to them taking action. I'm aware of federal statutes that would, in my opinion, potentially apply here. You referenced the piece that Andrew McCarthy, who has the experience as well doing this, what he wrote. So that's a decision to make because you have the ability to charge more seriously. There's more of a punishment. And by the way, this isn't just, I'm not just talking about myself. I'm just saying across the board, as far as a practice, because you have other members of Congress who have been attacked in the past and bad things have happened where state laws apply and federal laws apply. And the DOJ needs to be always looking seriously, regardless of whether or not it fits a narrative. I mean, President Biden put out a statement yesterday condemning the attack. I would imagine that this is on the Attorney General's radar, but I don't know. I haven't heard from him.
But Liz Elden, basically for your whole campaign over a year, crime's been the number one issue. And what happened to you, and with this guy now loose on the streets, wherever he may be, this is what you've been talking about. This is part and parcel. This is really the whole thrust of your campaign, is it not?
Yeah, I've been talking about this every moment of this campaign since before we even got into it. The need to repeal cashless bail, to unapologetically support our men and women in blue. In my opinion, we should keep qualified immunity. That's under attack. And it's only gotten worse with more pro-criminal laws that have gotten passed up in Albany. And they want to do more. They feel like they haven't gone enough. Mm. They're trying to pass a new law called the Clean Slate Act, where they would just wipe out all sorts of different criminal convictions of people's past that you as an employer might want to know before hiring someone, or you as owning a piece of property may want to know before renting out that space to somebody who maybe previously got in trouble for not paying and not doing what they needed to do in some other effort in the past. So they actually want to do more damage. They feel like they haven't gone pro-criminal enough in this state, and that's why we need to end one-party rule. We need to restore balance in Albany. We need to support our men and women in law enforcement across the state. We have to fire Kathy Hochul this November. This is bigger than me. This is about all of us as New Yorkers. It's not about Republican registered voters against Democrat registered voters. There are a lot of independents supporting us. There are a lot of disenfranchised Democrats supporting us. It's about all of us as New Yorkers uniting, coming together and saving the state.
You know, Liz Elden, at the top of the show, I talked about this and I basically said, you are the last hope for New York State and New York City. You are the last hope. And the issues here are very simple. They're crime, business, taxes in the economy, regulations, school choice and education. I want to make this real simple. You are the last hope. Crime needs to be stopped. The anti-business in New York's the highest tax state in the union. And, of course, the teachers union have destroyed education in the classroom. Bing, bing, bing. This is what you stand. You are the common sense candidate. All right. That's how I've expressed it. My very dear friend and the owner of this radio station, you know, John Katzimatidis well. He calls it common sense. All right. And I just think you, Lee Zeldin, are the common sense candidate to save New York.
Well, I agree. We need common sense. And these are obvious solutions to what are identified by New Yorkers to be their top issues. It's not because I said so or Larry Kudlow says so that we just declare that crime and the economy and education, that these are at the top of the list. That's not how it works. It's New Yorkers hitting their breaking point and fleeing the state. And they're saying this is what their breaking point is. For Kathy Hochul, if you ask her what are the top issues, do you know that she won't say any of that? And it's not because she believes that the top issues are something else. It's because she wants them to be something else. She doesn't want to talk about crime and the economy. And that really tells you a lot, because she's sitting in that seat right now. And this is the same problem we see down in Washington. When you're sitting in that seat, if you're not willing to identify what's wrong, offer up solutions, and accept responsibility, then you just need to move on out and let someone else fill that seat who's going to do the job.
All right. Lee Zeldin, for heaven's sakes, be safe on the campaign trail. God bless. We'll talk some more. Thanks ever so much for your time. Lee Zeldin, folks, the last hope for New York. Believe me. The last hope for New York. I'm Larry Kudlow. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Saturday.